Since the memory of man, or, as the children of Kame love to say, since millions of years, the world of art had been regulated by pretty stiff religious conventions, now imposed and continued in force by Amon-Re in his chapel, or by his powerful priesthood for him. To relax, or indeed wholly to remove these fetters for the sake of a new truth and beauty which the Aton god had revealed to Pharaoh, was a blow in the face to Amon-Re, the head and front of a religion and politics indissolubly bound up with certain pictorial conceptions consecrated by time. In young Pharaoh's disintegrating theories on the subject of the pictorial arts, the world whole spoke the language of good taste, one language among many in which it expresses itself. For with the world whole and its unity, the human being has always and ever to do, whether he knows it or not. He might know it, Amenhotep, the boy king, but the world whole was manifestly too much for him. His strength seemed to be too slender. He suffered too much. Often he was pale or green, even when he did not have to wear the jackal's tail. He was so tortured by headaches that he could not keep his eyes open. Often and often he had to give up his food. He was obliged to lie in the dark for days. He whose whole love was the light, the golden bond between heaven and earth, those rays ending in the caressing, life-giving hands of his father Aton. Of course, it was matter for grave concern when a reigning king was constantly prevented by such attacks from fulfilling his representational duties, such as offering sacrifice, dedicating this and that, receiving his wise men and counselors. But unfortunately, there was even worse. One could never tell what attack might suddenly seize his majesty in the middle of these duties, in the presence of dignitaries, or even of masses of people. Pharaoh, holding his thumbs clamped round by the other four fingers and rolling his eyeballs back under half-closed lids, might fall into a not quite normal, unconscious state, not lasting very long, but still a disturbing interruption to the business in hand. He himself explained these incidents as abrupt visitations from his father, the god, and he feared much less than he desired to receive them. For he returned from them with his daily life enriched by first-hand instruction and revelation on the true and beautiful nature of Aton. Thus it need cause us neither surprise nor doubt to learn that when the new son reached his majority, the point was discussed whether it might not be better to leave him under the maternal wing and let things go on as they were. But the idea came to nothing, despite Amun's representations in its favor. However much there was for it, there was too much against it. For to admit that Pharaoh was so ill or so sickly that he could not take over the government was contrary to the interests of the hereditary sun rulers, and might give rise to dangerous notions in the kingdom and the tributary states. Moreover, Pharaoh's attacks were of a nature which forbade their use as a reason for continuing his minority. They were holy. They contributed to his popularity, rather than otherwise. It would be unwise to make them the ground for a prolongation of his minority. It was much better to exploit them against Amun, whose private intention to unite the double crown with his own feather headdress and himself found a new dynasty lurked in the background of every situation. And so the maternal bird turned over to her son the full authority of the zenith of his manhood. But looking very closely, we can see that he himself, Amenhotpe, had conflicting feelings on the whole subject. He felt pride and joy in his new powers, but he felt embarrassment as well. All in all, he might have preferred to remain under his mother's wing. There was one reason why he looked forward with positive horror to his majority, and it was this. Every pharaoh at the beginning of his reign, by fixed tradition, personally undertook, as commander-in-chief, a military campaign of war and plunder into either the Asiatic or the Negro lands, and upon its glorious conclusion he was solemnly received at the border and escorted back to his capital, where he offered as tribute to Amon-Re, who had thus set the princes of Zehai and Cush under his feet, a goodly share of the swag. Pharaoh had also, with his own hand, to slay a half-dozen prisoners of war, as high as possible in rank. In case of need, they were elevated for the purpose. Of all such ceremonies, the Lord of the Sweet Breath knew himself to be utterly incapable. He was attacked by facial twitchings, pallor and greenness whenever they were mentioned, or even whenever he thought of them. He loathed war. It might be Amon's business, but was far from being that of my father Aton, who in one of those holy and questionable attacks of Manes had expressly revealed himself to his son as the Prince of Peace. Mani could neither take the field with steed and chariot, nor plunder, nor make presents of booty to Amon, nor slay in his honor princely or theoretically princely captives. He neither could nor would do any of that, even ostensibly and for form's sake, and he refused to be pictured on temple walls and arches shooting arrows from a lofty war chariot at terrified foes, or holding a bunch of them with one hand by the hair of their heads, and with the other brandishing the bludgeon. All that was to him, that is to say, to his god, and so to him, intolerable and impossible. It must be clearly understood by court and state that the inaugural campaign of plunder would not take place, that after all, it could be somehow got round by good will and good words. One could say that all the lands of the globe already lay at Pharaoh's feet, and tribute poured in so promptly and copiously that any warlike demonstration was superfluous. That, indeed, it was Pharaoh's wish to signalize his accession by the absence of such events. But even after this easement, Manes' feelings continued to be mixed. He did not conceal from himself that as a reigning monarch he came into immediate contact with the whole world and all its languages and ways of expressing itself, whereas up till then he could regard it from the one point of view which he preferred, the religious one. Not taken up with earthly affairs, among the flowers and trees of his gardens he could dream of his loving God, think him forth, muse upon him, and consider how his essence could best be comprehended in one name and represented by a single image. That had been strain and responsibility enough, but he loved it and gladly bore with the headaches it gave him. Now he had that to do and to think about, which gave him headaches he did not love at all. Every morning, with sleep still in all his members, he received the vizier of the south, a tall man with a little chin beard and two gold neck rings, named Ramosa. The man greeted him with a fixed form of address, like a litany, very florid and long-winded, and then for endless hours badgered him with rolls of marvelously executed writings about current administrative problems, judicial business, sentences, tax registers, plans for new canals, foundation stone laying, building supplies, opening of quarries and mines in the desert, and so on and on, instructing Pharaoh in Pharaoh's beautiful will in all these matters. After that, with upraised hands, he would marvel at the beauty of Pharaoh's will. It was Pharaoh's beautiful will to take such and such journeys into the desert, to designate the right spots for wells and post stations, after they had been picked out beforehand by people more competent in such matters. It was his admirably beautiful will to summon the city count of El Kab to come before his face for a hearing upon why he so unpunctually and insufficiently paid his official assessments of gold, silver, cattle, and linen into the treasury at Thebes. The next day, it was his exalted will to set out for miserable Nubia to lay a cornerstone or preside at an opening of a temple, usually one dedicated to Amon-Re, and thus in Mani's mind by no means compensating for the exhaustion and headache brought on by the journey. At best, the obligatory temple service, the cumbersome ritual of the imperial god, took up a great part of his time and strength. Outwardly, it was his beautiful will to perform it, but inwardly, it was the reverse, for it prevented him from thinking of Aton, and also it inflicted on him the society of Beknekons, Amon's autocratic servant, whom he could not abide. In vain had he tried to have his capital city called City of the Brightness of Aton. The name was not taken up by the people, the priests prevented them, and Wese was and remained Noet Amon, the city of the great ram. who, by the strong right arms of his royal sons, had reduced foreign lands to subjection and made Egypt rich. Even thus early, Pharaoh was secretly playing with the idea of removing his residence from Thebes, where the image of Amun-Re shone from every column and arch, column and obelisk, and was a vexation to his eyes. Certainly he did not yet think of founding a new city all his own, wholly dedicated to Aton. He only contemplated transferring the court to On, at the top of the delta, where he felt more at home himself. There, in the vicinity of the Sun Temple, he had a pleasant palace, not so brilliant as Merimat in the west of Thebes, but provided with all the comforts his delicate health required. The court chroniclers had often to record the journeys of the good god by boat or wagon down to On. True, it was the seat of the vizier of the north, who had under him the administration and judiciary functions of all the districts between Asyut and the delta, and who, in his turn, lost no time in giving him headaches, but at least at On, Meni was spared burning incense to Amun under the supervision of Beknekons, and he very much enjoyed talking with the learned shiny pates from the house of Atum-Re Horakhte about the nature of the glorious god his father and his inner life, which, despite his vast age, was so fresh and lively that it proved capable of the most beautiful variations, clarifications, and developments. If one may so express it, there emerged out of the old god, with the aid of human brain power, slowly, yet ever more completely, a new, unspeakably lovely one, namely, the wonderful, universally illuminating Aton. Oh, that one might give oneself wholly to him and be his son, midwife, herald, and confessor, instead of being king of Egypt as well, and successor of those who had enlarged the boundaries of Kemah and made it an empire. He was tied fast to them and to the deeds they had done. He was vowed to them and to all their acts. Probably the reason why he could not endure Beknekon's, Amon's man, was that he was right when he constantly emphasized the fact. In other words, young Pharaoh himself, in his most private self-examination, suspected it. He suspected first that it was one thing to found an empire, and another to help a world god into being, and second, that the latter occupation might easily be in some kind of contradiction to the regal task and responsibility of preserving and sustaining the achievements of the past. And the headaches which made him shut his eyes when the viziers of the north and the south set upon him with imperial business were connected with suspicions to the effect, or not quite to the effect, but moving in that direction, that they, namely the headaches, were not caused so much by fatigue and boredom as by a vague but disquieting insight into the conflict between devotion to the beloved Aton theology and the duties of a king of Egypt. In other words, they were conscience and conflict headaches. Knowing them for what they were only made them worse instead of better, and increased his nostalgia for his former state of protection under the wing of maternal night. Doubtless, not only he, but the country too, would have been better off, for an earthly land and its prosperity are always better taken care of by the mother, however much the spiritual side may be so in the hands of the son. This was Amenhotep's private conviction, and it was probably the feeling of Egypt itself, the Isis belief in the black earth which she instilled into it. Meni made a mental distinction between the material, earthly, natural welfare of the earth and its mental and spiritual weal. He vaguely feared that the two concerns might not only not coincide, but even conflict rather fundamentally. To be charged with both of them at once, to be both priest and king, was the source of many headaches. The material and natural well-being and prosperity were the business of the king, or even better, it was the business of a queen, of the mother, the great cow, in order that the priest's son, in freedom and without responsibility for material well-being, might dwell on the spiritual side and spin his son thoughts. His royal responsibility for the material side oppressed young Pharaoh. His kingship was for him bound up with the black Egyptian loam between desert and desert, black and fertile from the impregnating water, whereas his passion was the pure light, the golden sun-youth of the heights, and he had no good conscience about it. The vizier of the south, who got all the reports, even about the early rising of the dog star which heralds the swelling of the waters, this Ramosa, then, constantly called his attention to the latest news on the state of the river, the prospects of a good rise, the fertilization, the harvest. To Maney, however attentively, yes, conscientiously he listened, it seemed as though the man would much rather give his reports, as he used to the mother, the Isis Queen. She knew more about these things. They were better off in her hands. And yet for him, too, as for his lands, everything depended on a blessing issue in the dark fields of fertility. Failure or deficiency, if it came, reflected on him. Not for nothing did Egypt's people have a king who was God's son, and so in God's name represented an assurance against stoppages in holy and necessary processes upon which nobody else had any influence. Mistakes or damages in this department of the black earth meant that his people were disappointed in him, whose mere existence should have prevented them. His credit was shaken, and after all he needed all he could get, that he might make to triumph the beautiful teaching of Aton and his nature of heavenly light. That was the difficulty and the dilemma. He had no bond with the blackness below, loving alone the upper light. But if things did not go smoothly and well with the blackness that fed them all, he lost his authority as teacher of the light. And so young Pharaoh's feelings suffered from a split when the motherly night took away her wing from above him and handed him over the kingdom.